top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
Strange case. No sign of violence, yet she looks completely contorted in fear. Almost as if she'd been frightened to death. As if she'd seen something too horrible to live through.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
You mean the masterpiece isn't finished yet, Mr. Moon?
Almost. I'm gonna need another week.
It's finished. I mean, you know we need the money, so why don't you face up to it?
We'll take it. It's great.
It's 2 a.m, guys.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 235, The Driller Killer.
And I'm glad that you put the definite article in front of it, The Driller Killer, because most of the times when you hear this film referred to, people just call it Driller Killer, but it really is The Driller Killer. And this was a film that was released in 1979, and it was, I guess, the debut feature-length film of provocateur, filmmaker, artist, raconteur, I don't know. What other attributes I give him? Abel Ferrara, who I'm a big fan of. In addition to this, he made Bad Lieutenant.
The original, not the Herzog one, or the original cool one, really cool one.
But they're both worthy to watch. I mean, Herzog's is a fabulous Nicolas Cage performance. Yeah. Got to see just for that. But the Harvey Keitel Bad Lieutenant, famous for the Harvey Keitel full frontal nudity. He also made a film called Body of Evidence starring Madonna that I've never seen.
It's a notorious flop.
Yeah. He made
critical flop.
Yet another remake, reimagining, re-envisioning, whatever you want to call it, of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But besides this one, I think his crowning achievement was Miss 45, which I believe he made directly after Driller Killer. And that's a fantastic film. That's a film we should revisit down the road. But this is Driller Killer. And this is a film that in horror circles is somewhat, I don't know if I infamous, I don't know how to, because it was a video nasty. And it just goes to show the very capricious nature of video nasties. And we did a whole podcast talking about video nasties and so on and so forth. But when you compare this film to some of the other video nasties, like the real gut munchers, like your Burial Grounds or your Cannibal Ferox or what have you, this is not that bad. Not by a long shot. And yet, it wasn't available in Britain until 1999. Maybe they were just waiting for the Prince song to come to fruition. But why was it very nasty? Because of two things. The title and the box art for the VHS. Because it would depict the one guy that got drilled directly in the forehead, which was rather gruesome.
Which was awesome.
And awesome. But the film itself, I mean, and that's the whole thing. If you're a hardened horror fan and you just want to see the gorgeous of the gore and you want to make your way down the video nasty list, you're going to get The Driller Killer and you're not going to be very happy because it's more of an art film than anything else. Yes, it does have gore. Yes, there's a murderer. Yes, there's some horrific elements. But this is an art film through and through. And I appreciate it for those reasons. In many ways, I thought that this was a really good depiction of the time and place it was set, New York City. But, of course, this was not, you know, Manhattan proper. You never saw the Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building.
This was filmed where? And
I just thought it was just somewhere in Manhattan, but it just has more like in common with Taxi Driver and Mean Streets than any kind of horror film at the time. It's really weird.
This is almost like a bit of a combo of Taxi Driver and Combat Shock.
Uh-huh.
You know, somebody trying to make their way in the mean streets of the big city, New York. Taxi Driver, because he ultimately goes crazy by living in this urban milieu, and he wants to, you know
the
clean
feeling.
Up the streets and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's that. And, again, like I said, we don't see the Times Square. We don't see the Deuce. We don't see... But this is still New York when it was kind of the Big Apple rocking to its core. So what we've got going here is... And before we actually talk about the film proper, I found it kind of ironic as I was watching it, because I'm assuming it was shot in some borough like Brooklyn or what have you. And I'm watching going, not one of the actors in this movie, and I don't know, and I wouldn't put it past Ferreira, because I'm sure he had zero permits. This was guerrilla filmmaking at its finest. Some of those winos were probably real winos, right? Mm-hmm. Some of those derelicts. But let's say they weren't. Let's say they were actors. Of course, Ferreira himself played the main character, Reno. But not one of the actors in this movie, nor the filmmaker himself, Ferreira, could afford to live in those neighborhoods nowadays.
Oh, for sure.
You know? So, yeah, back then, it was urban decay, it was urban rot, there were winos, there were drunks. I mean, he kept flashing the shots of these, and I think I know why. I think I understand what he's trying to say, but it's ironic that an actor that appeared in a movie set in these neighborhoods would not be able to rent in an apartment in those neighborhoods nowadays.
It's wild, as I said, like a guy with artistic pretensions. I think he did a movie about Pier Paolo Pasolini, if I'm not mistaken. He lives in Europe. He has all this stuff, and you have that influence right off the bat, where a weird, surrealistic engagement with a parish priest, and they touch hands, and you don't know the backstory of how these two guys are connected, mm-hmm. but you can infer maybe that he was possibly molested,
because
but
he goes
you never
crazy.
Know.
Right.
He goes crazy, but it's just put out there as a weird thing to think about.
We're
accustomed to not thinking about anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you compare this to Toolbox Murders, and with which I've often gotten this confused in the memory banks. Both toolbox type materials used to murder people. That one has no artistic pretensions.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a guy going around killing people. This has murkiness, strangeness, dreamlike fugue states. They're leading you. Maybe he's trying to lead people astray. There's more going on here than meets the eye.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you keep saying pretensions, because pretension sounds pejorative, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I would say this had not pretensions, but artistic
aspirations. Okay,
exactly. Because I didn't find it pretentious. To me, this almost reminded me of a bit of something that would have come out of like Warhol's factory back in the day. Like, it had that sort of artistic vibe of trying to, you know, see what we can do with no permits, guerrilla filmmaking. Let's tell a story and let's just make a movie. So I didn't find pretentious in the least. Yeah, there was a lot of like weird quick cuts to different art and stuff. And
I guess it's a dictionary.com, whether it's pretensions is different from pretentious. I hope it is, because, yeah, I would tend to agree.
Mm-hmm.
And it, I guess it doesn't help matters that the guy's an artist as well. He's Reno, is it Miller? I forget his name. It sounds like a football player.
Reno,
I don't know.
Nevada.
Reno, Nevada. And he's got all this fantastic piece that he's trying to sell in his apartment. It's a buffalo, which is almost like a, I don't know, like a Picasso bull. Like, it has this big snorting face, and he's trying to sell it. He's got a great art dealer who's uptown,
mm-hmm.
and he refers to him on various occasions as a faggot, so this is obviously language of the time. But I like his art, and that's whenever you see an artist depicted in a movie or a musician, you want to hear or see something that is good. If someone, he's supposed to be a lauded, you know, is maybe struggling, but like reputed, reputable artist.
Well,
and
patrons.
I liked his stuff.
He had a patron, like this
a patron,
guy.
Yeah.
And obviously he had people that bought his art. Now, I would not be surprised that art itself was done by Ferrara.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure. I'm just surmising, because I'm sure that Ferrara was sort of like a, when it comes to art, he's got his hands in all the different mediums.
For sure.
So Reno is living in this very spacious loft with a bunch of girls, and they all work in the arts in some form or fashion, right? Some are models, some are photographers, some are this, and they're always complaining about finances and not having enough money to make the rent. But it's hilarious.
Oh no, I was just gonna say $500 for rent.
Well,
my God, yeah.
I know. And you see how big their loft was.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they have this wonderful abode, and that they keep showing these people in the streets as derelicts, you know, drinking, like, and barely able to make it through the day. And I think that by juxtaposing the two, he was trying to say, like, you know, these pretentious artists, and this is, I'll use the word pretentious, you know, they're complaining about this, that, and the other. Meanwhile, when you juxtapose it with the people that really are destitute,
it's all relative. Starving artist versus someone who's actually starving. Yeah, that was great. Mm-hmm. And the attention to detail is something, not just the art, but the music is fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, it's period to a T with the 1970s, late 70s St. Mark's scene that would have been happening at the time with all those incredible bands that came out of New York. Yeah. That was really fun.
And that's something about this film. I mean, there's a lot of extended musical performances, whether it's this band rehearsing, whether they're, because they move into the same, I guess you would call it,
art space.
Yeah. And
squat house.
And yeah, they pretty much rehearse 24 hours a day, and I would say systematically drive Reno nuts, in addition to some other stuff. But that's not atypical of Ferrara, because in Miss 45, the film stops for these extended musical performances. There's this band near the end, the climax of the film. I actually bought the soundtrack on vinyl because it was so fantastic. 45? No, it was a full length, but nice pun. I like it. A horn band. It was this really cool swing tune. So Ferrara would do that quite a bit, as he would just stop the film for a musical performance, you know? And this is a movie that takes his time setting up the place, setting up the character, setting up the scenario. I mean, obviously, our protagonist is Reno. Not only is he our protagonist, he's also the auteur behind this film. And if you're going to take the film and just describe it in like your sort of elevator pitch, whatever, why don't you sense is, man living in urban jungle slowly goes nuts. End of story. And he takes out his frustrations on various lowlifes and destitutes using a power grip. Whether it's through their forehead, whether it's through their hand, their neck, whatever, whether he's impaling people. Great, great kills. Great deaths. But that's like the last third of the film when he starts becoming the quote-unquote thriller killer. Before that is just sort of a character piece about the lives of these people in New York and Reno. Yeah, again, you mentioned, like, you know, we get that he's a tortured artist. And the whole thing with the, we don't know, why did he go to the church? What was the point? And why did he run out in horror when he was touched? Yes, of course, we can infer that he was molested. And there's a lot more to Reno than is exposed, told, etc. And I like that. I like movies where they give you clues and it's up to the audience to then infer what is actually going on.
Yeah, well, maybe the connection is, again, between the destitutes and the derelicts and the starving artists. Maybe he's trying to drive home the connection between madness and art. I wasn't sure about that, like whether a Van Gogh type of scenario that he needed madness to drive him. But even when he gets progressively more crazy, you can't, it's not like a demarcation point where he totally turned.
Like, in the aforementioned taxi driver, I mean, there's the moment when Travis Bickle shaves the head and he has the iconic mohawk and the army fatigues and does a whole, you know, you talk to me and that. So from the mirror, that was a demarcation. Like, that's when this guy went over the edge. Whereas with Reno, it was just sort of more gradual. In fact, I think what was a real sort of catalyst for him to sort of snap was he witnessed a stabbing and murder, a broad daylight murder in a park, I believe. And
the indifference that occurred thereafter. Mm-hmm. With just, I guess it speaks to just the cold, dispiriting, inhuman life that, well, both of us lead in a major city. And that was pretty captivating too. So they're asking questions of his conscience right there. And there you have like 5 to 10 bystanders just doing absolutely nothing. But also with cool bits of foreshadowing. I mean, sure, the film is called The Driller Killer, but if I'm not mistaken, the first 10 minutes, one of his live-in threesome artist, band member, girlfriends,
Carol, perhaps.
She needs a hole drilled in the doorway. And there's this protracted scene where he's saying, is it here? Should I put it here? Should I put it here? And it's, it was just funny and kind of quirky and something you don't usually see. Mm-hmm. Because from the outset, he doesn't seem altogether disturbed. And his,
when you have somebody running out of a church shrieking the minute a priest touches your hand, I mean, there's something there that's not quite you know, there's got to be something percolating under the surface. So, but you're right. I mean, he doesn't seem like he's not overtly aggressive. Yeah, he gets in a few arguments with Bruce.
Yeah, he's trying to pay the bills, so he's having a rough time of life. But he's not your typical psycho that you would see in these types of films. Like when you compare it to, I don't know, Don't Answer the Phone or The Toolbox Murders, the aforementioned one. It's like set right off the bat, telegraphed that the guy's going to be psycho.
And that's the thing too. Like we that's to this film's credit, is that we don't get the rigor, you know, backstory, the flashback scene. Oh, this is Reno when he was a child, and this is what he witnessed, and this is what turned him into what he became. No, we see Reno as of today, and we see him slowly but subtly become a murderer, and we just sort of have to piece together, you know, what is going on in his psyche to make him lash out the way he does. And it should be noted that when he does go on his killing sprees, and most of the people that he is murdering, most, not all, are people that are living on the streets. Just like, there's never any witnesses. And if there is, they're indifferent. This is this human detritus that he's getting rid of.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but another thing that I noticed, like, and this is very similar to Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, another one of our mutual faves. You don't see any law enforcement anywhere. And not a squad car driving by, not a policeman on their beat, nothing. In Henry, there's this one scene where you see a cruiser like racing down the highway.
That's off in the distance. Yeah, almost.
So it gives you that sense, like, this is a very lawless world. This is like the Wild Wild West transplanted in New York City in the late 70s. And because you don't see any law enforcement, you almost get the sense that Reno, when he goes out there, and again, we don't even know, like, why is he doing this? Why is he killing these people? It's never fully articulated. But it still seems wholly earned all the same. And, well, I mean,
I know what you mean.
I'm saying, right? But yeah, when he goes out there and starts killing, there's no expectation on the viewer's part that he's going to get caught or that by the police. Or that. In fact, I got to tell you, the ending was the ending was just a wee bit ambiguous. And I don't know if I want to spoil the ending too much, but it kind of just ends on a very sort of blasé note, which is almost like good in a sense. It's like he did his last kill, he did his major kill, and then he just goes home to whatever life he had before and nothing. You know, it's funny because, like, murder. Okay. I can never, ever picture taking someone's life in any capacity, you know?
Mercy killing?
Well, one of the reasons that we were just talking before we started recording. I currently don't have a driver's license, right? I want to get my license back. The reason why I don't have a driver's license is because I got into two accidents, major accidents, in the period of, like, say, 2 years, where I rode off cars both times. It was no inebriation, there was no speeding, it was just inclement weather, bad luck. Both times, thank God, nobody got hurt. One of the things I was so that really affected me is the fact that, like, I was alone both times in the car. And I kept saying, well, God forbid, if there was a passenger, a relative, somebody next to me, a child, and I get into an accident, that person is injured or killed, I don't think I can live with myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just an accident. But they say that with certain killers, like, it becomes as natural as breathing. Once you do it once, you do it again. You do it again. You do it again. I will never test that theory.
Well, if Law and Order SVU has taught us anything, that killers like to, it's probably total horseshit, but killers like to escalate, and they start off, and maybe they're interrupted, and then they gradually get better at their craft, as if it's like
I totally get that, because I think killing is like is a transgressive act like anything else. When you sort of transgress a boundary and you sort of get away with it, then you're like, okay, well, now that thrill has been satiated. Now it's a bigger thrill, and I have to continue doing it, and it has become grander and more, let's say, potential for risk or for I don't know.
I hope it's not like the author of Blink and you need 10,000 hours to master your craft. Like, it's so depressing.
That was the Beatles, not Ted Bundy. But anyway, I'm going to just say that's what they say when it comes to serial killers. It becomes like, I'm thinking even that, you know, Dexter, we started off a show with such great promise and it just became god awful, but it just becomes as natural as
respiration.
And you kill and you can go home to a life of pure domestic bliss, or in this case, some uncertainty with this, he sort of had a coven of harem of women, But yeah.
Well, I'm trying to think of other films, because for the most part, you don't get to see victims in slasher films who are from the other side of the tracks.
That's not
entirely the bulk true. Of the yeah, I guess you get lots of prostitutes and that, but for the most part, they're this relatable middle class people. That I guess it's a conceit because that's who comprises the audience. But this the entire. The bulk of his victims, with the exception of the art dealer, are down and outs.
See, that's why that's crazy. Why like, spoil,
oh, okay,
that's
yeah,
okay, it's whatever. Just,
that's pretty affecting because similar to Jack the Ripper, he preys upon people nobody cares about, and that's really that added a new dimension of pathos that again you don't get in most slasher stalk and slash. Films where you have someone drunk and stupid and frankly annoying get offed and you really don't care after they've doffed their tops and whatnot. But one of the guys here, when he approaches him,
was very affecting.
It was affecting because he engaged him. I mean, the bum engaged Reno in a very standard conversation, like, oh, you must be, you work in the trades, like, I see bum, you've got a drill, like, it was a tough day at work.
The bum had compassion for Reno. He even wanted to help him with his limited means, and he gets a drill in the forehead, or wherever.
Yeah, that was really tough. Yeah. That was tough.
No, I mean, look, one of the misconceptions about me as a film viewer that a lot of people have, including some of my friends and acquaintances, is that all I watch is horror, and that's not true. I love any form of cinema, And I do really like artsy experimental movies. To me, this was a wonderful blend of an art film with some horrific elements, and I was almost ashamed of myself for not having seen it all these years. Amazing. I mean, this was a film that was in the public domain for many, many years. How many of those compilations, that you pick up with like 50 horror films has Thriller Killer in a really god-awful print?
Oh, yeah, an awful print. Yeah, the first time I saw it, it was a terrible, terrible print, and I thought there must be something more to this movie because of who was involved. So I thought I'm going to revisit it and pay more attention. As I was just skipping through, and I did find a better print, and it looked more pristine. And I read more about Abel Ferreira and what he was all about, and then I just turned more, my non-jaded eyes toward it. And there's more to this than meets the eye,
sure. Well, this was my first viewing. Luckily, Arrow Video saw fit to restore this for a Blu-ray release. Equally as lucky, Arrow Video sends me pre-release copies of a lot of their movies. I get a lot of movies from Arrow. In fact, our next episode will be another film that I got from Arrow. It looked as good as it could ever look. You know what I mean? This will never look like fucking The Avengers, whatever, the new one, Thanos Kills Everybody. No, this is Thriller Killer. This was probably shot on 16mm, blown up to 35, what have you. It's grainy, but it looked decent. It looked decent. It was a good clean to print, so good on Arrow for that. And I'm happy that I discovered, because I mean, I've always known that Thriller Killer is just this movie with that lurid title and that lurid box cover art. And as a fan of Miss 45 and Bad Lieutenant, you would think I would go to Thriller Killer, but I just never got around to it. So this was a pleasure for me to watch.
Oh, likewise. So what did you learn?
A lot. This scene, I mean, oftentimes in art movies, there are scenes of pretentious gratuity, and in this case, it was gratuitous pizza eating. At one point, Reno just decides to mow down on a large pizza in the most uncouth way possible. Yeah. So that was interesting.
And lots of crust left in discarded boxes, and it was pretty gross. Lots of pizza eating, yeah.
Another thing that I learned is that nostalgia is a funny beast. It's amazing what things you can see that you get nostalgic for. This being filmed in the late 70s, obviously there's going to be things that are a little bit different. And at one point, Reno opens up his fridge to get a snack of some sort, and there's a Big Mac sitting in his fridge. And it was a Big Mac in this old school styrofoam container, back in the days when it was under heat. And I just remember that. I got so nostalgic for the old school Big Mac when... You know, I was a little kid and I would get one. And
no, my parents wouldn't let me have McDonald's. Yeah. So it was such a treat. Like I had to, they wouldn't let me have Kraft dinner or mac and cheese for American friends. And I could only have that when I was going camping because my parents were into this organic food and my dad being Italian.
Your childhood was terrible, dude.
Slow
I tell
food
you. You
movement.
Didn't read comic books.
Oh,
so.
I know. Yeah.
No, so no really, wonder you're all as this tight deprivation. As
but yeah, so I was out on my own and could scrounge together $5, I was off to McDonald's. And boy, did that taste good at the time.
Yeah, for sure. And that's like, as I said before, like now they don't keep the food in the heat lamp and you end up waiting like 30 minutes for so-called fast food and you get your Big Mac in this cardboard container. You have to, of course, it's more environmentally friendly, but there's just something about those in those styrofoam containers that were so, it just hit me in my heart for nothing. I remember the McDLT, which I loved. It was the best sandwich ever. Keeps the hot side hot and the cold side cold. And everybody, like, not everybody, but the people that I know are clamoring, bring back the McDLT. It was the best thing you've ever put out. But because it's a packaging that relies on a lot of styrofoam, and styrofoam packaging is allowed in any mom and pop takeout, but McDonald's, God forbid, we'll never get that McDLT again. Oh, man. No. So how do we talk from go from Driller Killer to the McDLT? I don't know, but that's what I learned. What did you learn, girls?
Oh, well, I'm going to, you know, carry over from your point of nostalgia, and whether it's misplaced or not, because I have a certain sense of nostalgia for a time I never experienced, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
because
late 70s, we always, New York City, right?
Yeah, we always picture ourselves by a boat in a river, you know, like you know, the Beatles sang. No, picture yourself in like the Bowery, which is referenced in this film, in the 70s. Like, it would have been terrifying. But yet we have this romantic notion that we would somehow survive there. Like, I was scared of punks as a little kid. And God knows, like, being surrounded by a bunch of them as an adult, especially because I'm kind of square looking, assuming I look the way I do now, if I were hanging out in the East Village, I'd get my ass whooped. Well, and as you know here, people want to kick my ass. Yeah. I don't know
people
what it
kick
is.
Kick your ass globally. Dude.
Yeah,
we
it's
were
true.
In England
that's
twice, true. You almost had your ass kicked. But anyway.
Yeah, I got mugged in Italy, so yeah,
just,
people
just
do not
people
like
off
me. Yeah.
No, I don't understand why. But it's funny because I say that often to people when I talk about the, because you know what a big Ramones fan I am, right? And how much I would have loved to have been able to be transplanted back in like the late 70s, 77, 78, New York City, Bowery, CBGBs. But then I think to myself, would I even have the fucking cojones to go there? Because to go to CBGBs, you had to go through a literal minefield of junkies and pimps and hookers and people shooting up in the street and alcoholics and, I mean...
All sorts of, yeah,
we
Demi,
were just
Demi Mont.
A man without a home, I guess, you know, just before we started recording outside my building. And I could tell there's some visible, you had a bit of visible discomfort, you know, every time we talked to this guy.
Well, I felt so bad as the guy explained to us he was living in a shelter and it was probably a cock and bull story about wanting to get something for his girlfriend at the local hospital. But you never know. As I've had these conversations with these guys and it's really heartbreaking. But by the same token, we're powerless to do anything is... Although to their credit, the guys who say, "Can you just buy me food?" I mean, I find that like really touching, and I'll try and do that when I can, as opposed to just give me change, because then you're just financing somebody's habits. But then if you were like this, you would want to drink too. So I mean, why would you not want to be drunk if you were like this? So I withhold judgment.
To add the sadness to the story, because I came down to meet with no money in my pocket. This gentleman wanted to buy flowers too for his girlfriend. You know. Wine and flowers, and then he said to me at one point, he goes, "Should I just take them?" I'm like, I was about to say I would, but then I said, "No, don't, you do what you want to do." But all I'm saying to you is, yes, we romanticize that era, but would we actually be part of that scene? I don't know if we would have had, like as I said before, the cojones to be part of it.
Probably not.
I'm not saying we were, you know, we're definitely not beautiful enough to be part of Studio 54, but we'd be in some downmarket disco club dancing to the fucking Bee Gees to tie into our last week's podcast.
I don't know what kind of subculture I would have been in any other era. I was thinking about that too. I'm not a big fan of hippies, but I really like the kindness and the drugs. But I don't like the whole maybe because we both work really hard and I hate that kind of drop out of society thing. It's just so tired.
Yeah.
But you never know. Maybe if we were caught up in it in 1968, that would be us.
And a lot of it is
I'd call you Star Child or something.
A lot of it's geographical. I mean, if you're in San Francisco, you're going to be a hippie. If you're in fucking Congress Street in London, you're going to be that. Or a mod or what have you. But if you're in New York City in the late 70s,
You're either disco or punk.
And so you're either going to 54, you're going to fucking CBGB's or Max's Kansas City, and you're walking the New York Dolls, and you're watching
Blondie and Talking Heads. Oh my god, man, like, that would have been so great.
What a time. Oh. I mean, even Bruce Springsteen played Max's Kansas City.
That's
for God's
so
sakes.
Cool.
A solo show. Whoa. Anyway.
Oh, and speaking of music, another thing I learned is the song that the Roosters, the punk band here, kept playing. It was almost like a knockoff of that 1950s spy show called Peter Gunn. It's going like dun 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 dun, and they kept reprising that song, and it was pretty funny. Another thing I learned was this has, as far as bumsploitation films go, Street Trash is probably the apotheosis. That's, I love Street Trash. I've seen it like, oh man, a bunch of times. It's so good, but it doesn't have that kind of empathy and heart that this does. So it just has bums who are almost like a backdrop to create gross set pieces. But this occupies a unique space, I would say, in horror, for featuring homeless people.
But the whole thing is, like I said before, like, I don't know if I can call this a horror film. I don't know. It was a video nasty. It's always on the horror compilations because it was in the PD public domain. But it's, to me, it's not a horror film. Like, I don't consider Seven a horror film, you know? Like, do you consider that a horror film?
Not particularly, no.
I consider, like, you know, these are, like, human dramas, character pieces that may have some horrific elements, but they're not horror films per se. Seven, to me, is like a thriller, you know? I always demarcate horror and horrific. And in a sense, this was horrific when Reno goes on his killing spree, but it really wasn't that horrific, and it certainly did not deserve to be a video nasty. But a lot of movies, like, for example, Don't Go Into the Woods, I'm just looking at right now, my Blu-ray of that. I mean, that
is the most, yeah.
Yeah. We had to go back.
Unwarranted
video nasty. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty shitty film, but it's so bad. I mean, we did a podcast on it, so you can go back and check the archives. Having said that, I think I pretty much said everything I could say about Thriller Killer at this point.
Star rating.
4 stars for me, man.
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
I like art films, and I like horror. So it's like chocolate and peanut butter. Put it together. I love it, man.
I'll give it 3.5 to 3.75. Just fantastic upon rewatch. And a lot going on. A lot of talent and a lot of ability. And a lot of characterization. And I like the guy's descent into madness. Mm-hmm.
I wonder what happened to that actor that played Reno. He was pretty, pretty good. I'm just kidding. That was Farrar himself, yeah.
Yeah, and well, and for more, check out our podcast with new episodes of genre films.
Continue checking our podcast.
Oh,
you're
of course.
You're listening to it right now if you're hearing Chris say it.
Yeah, so. And send us an email for, let's say, I think we've covered, a lot of video nasties, but there's a bunch we haven't. And of course, the good old admonition movies, don't do this, don't do that. We have a few more to do of those.
There's a lot.
There's
do. There's a musical I'm going to suggest you write as soon as we press stop on record, because you know we did the god awful Sergeant Pepper last week. I got one for you that we got to do. That's going to be, I think we're.
Oh, I can't wait, because it's from Justin DeKelly, was dynamite. I love the apple. Love all this stuff.
Yep.
So shoot us an email, reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter, awful_movies.
Every suggestion seriously.
Every single suggestion we take seriously, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.